So I suggest to continue playing with flat surfaces, and I remind that the flat surfaces for us is, well, the best way to think of flat surfaces, which we consider in this story, is the following one. One considers a polygon in a plane, a polygon constructed in a, for example, in the following way. So we have a broken line from several vectors, not necessarily four arbitrary number of vectors. Then we repeat, we construct another broken line starting from the very same point, using the same vectors but in the other order, according to some permutation. So here the permutation is 4, 3, 2, 1. So we apply V4, V3, V2, V1. So if we are lucky and under some assumptions on the permutations which were formulated last time, we are lucky for an open domain of in the space of, well, broken lines, we get a polygon. And now from this polygon we glue a flat surface identifying the corresponding sides, which are not necessarily opposite. It depends on the permutation. And we identify the sides by parallel translations. We get a surface which has flat metric. So the vertices of the polygon usually give conical singularities, and our surface is extremely flat in the sense that the holonomy of the metric is trivial. So as soon as, and this was another, this was a convention. We choose the direction, the vertical direction, and we, so as soon as we made the choice, at some point we can transport this vertical direction everywhere, since the gluing rules, so since we identify the size of the polygon just by parallel translations, so there are no rotations, this defines this vertical direction everywhere, and the choice of vertical direction makes part of the structure. So we want to distinguish between two flat surfaces obtained from this polygon and from this polygon turned by some angle. So for us, this is two different objects. So in yesterday we stopped at the crucial point. So we considered families of flat surfaces, and fortunately there is a group action on this family which is extremely naive. So thinking of a flat surface as from a surface glued from this polygonal pattern, just apply a linear transformation to the plane where this polygon is. So, and here the assumption that we distinguish between polygon and rotated polygon, well, flat surface and rotated flat surface, becomes really very important. So if we put this polygon in some other place in the plane and we apply linear transformation, after linear transformation we obtain a polygon of the shape which does not depend on the position in the plane up to parallel transport. So we take a flat surface. So thinking correctly, we take a flat surface, we unfold it into polygonal part and put it on the plane, apply linear transformation. The polygon after a linear transformation, say, as a linear transformation, one can choose the linear transformation which shrinks everything vertically and expands everything horizontally. So the resulting polygon will change the shape. It would be something like this. However, the property that the corresponding sides of the polygon are parallel and have equal length is still preserved because we applied linear transformation. So we can again identify, well, this is V1 prime, V2 prime, V3 prime, V4 prime, V4 prime, V3 prime, V2 prime, V1 prime. So vector VG prime is obtained, is the image of corresponding vector VG under a linear transformation in the group GL2R. Well, plus, I want to preserve the orientation. Now, from this polygon, we can glue new flat surface. And it would be really new flat surface because the metric on this surface is completely different. So if you measure, say, the length of geodesics or whatever, well, everything is different. So we change the structure and we get an action of the linear group on our family of flat surfaces. Now, of course, it's clear that neither the genus nor the number of conical singularities nor the cone angles are these singularities. So all data concerning geometric, combinatorial geometry of the surface. So nothing would change. So we really stay inside our family of flat surfaces, and we get group action on every family of flat surfaces. I remind that for us, a family is something where we fix as much as possible of combinatorial data. So the genus, number of conical singularities, cone angles, etc. Fine. So this is the action of GL2R. If we want to fix the area of the surface, then one can consider the action of SL2R, and we get the action of the hypersurface of, well, hyper variety of flat surfaces of area 1. And also there is a special subgroup in this group, a diagonal subgroup, and action of the diagonal subgroup is called terminal geodesic flow. And for us, it's not important that it's geodesic flow, that this is a terminal geodesic flow, but the reason why this section is called like this is because it's really possible to define some metric, which is called terminal metric, on the moduli space of complex structures. Now, the moduli space of pairs, which we consider complex structure plus holomorphic one form, or in other words, our families of flat surfaces, this is sort of, it can be, these families can be identified with totally geodesic submanifolds in the tangent space to the moduli space of complex structures. And this action really becomes the geodesic flow. But this I prefer to hide under the carpet because it's not, in this lecture it's of no importance for us in a sense. Okay, so this is the action of the group. And now one more structure which is very important, and that would be more or less the end of presentation of basics concerning these spaces of flat surfaces. So we have a nice invariant measure on every family. So this was the action of the group. And this is, I remind that this is family of flat surfaces with cone angles 2 pi b1 plus 1, etc., 2 pi dm plus 1, sum of dj equals 2g minus 2. So these numbers are integers, and they correspond just to different partitions of the number 2g minus 2 in a collection of, in an unordered collection of integers. So each family like this has a nice invariant measure, and this measure can be defined, well, in several ways. The most naive way, using this picture with a polygon, is as follows. This is just dv1, etc., dvn, provided the choice of this broken line was sufficiently economic, or to be more, to make it smart, we identified the vectors v1, v3, etc., with the relative periods of the homology of the first homology of the surface relative with respect to collection of singularities. So if the vectors v1, etc., represent a basis, an integer basis, we are fine. So this is one way, and sorry, I had to put a constant here, because so if I don't want to care about the basis, the constant will save the. No, sorry, I still want to keep the constant. Now I want to give another definition of this measure, definition prime. I want to profit, however, from this complex analytic language. We spent so much time on the dictionary that now it would be stupid not to to profit from this. So this measure is just the linear measure in the vector space. And now this is the first cohomology of the surface relative with respect to conical singularities, which is, this is just a finite set, so this is a finite set of points, and with complex coefficients, normalized by the lattice . So now I have to decrypt what is written on the blackboard. I remind that we managed to identify that we actually identified a open domain in the family, in each family like this, with an open domain in this vector space, in the first cohomology of the surface relative with the conical singularities. So this space locally governs completely all deformations of our flat surfaces. So locally there is no difference between this space and this space, and this space is a vector space. It has just a linear volume element. We can take this volume element with the only precision that when we have a vector space, we don't know usually how to normalize the volume element. There is a whole family of volume elements. We can multiply volume element by 2 or by square root of 3, and this is also a linear volume element. However, in this case, we can profit that we have not just an abstract vector space, it has topological interpretation, it's cohomology space, and in this cohomology, we have cohomology with integer coefficients, with coefficients z plus cz. So we have a lattice in our vector space, and we can now, as soon as we have a lattice, we have a canonical choice of a volume element. We can normalize the fundamental domain of the lattice to have volume 1. So we do this. Of course, this is coordinate, so there might be changes of coordinates and so on, but changes of coordinates correspond to linear transformations in cohomology, which are induced by diffeomorphisms of the surface. So these transformations are symplectic. They do preserve this volume element. So they preserve the lattice. So we really have correctly defined volume element. And now I can formulate, so we have a nice volume element in every family like this. Now, one more precision. So, families like this are, well, rather nice. Especially looking at this identification, one can guess, and this guess is true, that this is a complex analytic orbifold. However, they are hopelessly non-compact, because having a flat surface like this, we can make a homothesy and we get another flat surface in the same family. So I want to get rid of, yeah? In this? So I consider this as a vector, as a two-dimensional, so actually, I have to write dvx, dvy. So this is a vector in two dimensions. Just Lebesgue measure. Which is basically, well, this is the same thing, in a sense. So I want to get rid of this stupid non-compactness. And to get rid of this stupid non-compactness, either one can make a projectivization, or one can make, which is almost the same, sort of hypersection in our space. I prefer to take a hypersection. I prefer to normalize the area of a surface by 1, to consider only area 1 flat surfaces. So let's consider the real co-dimension 1 subspace was it M? So this is a real co-dimension 1. So this is already better, and this subspace can be considered as a unit hyperboloid in this space because actually it's defined in our coordinates in terms of by quadratic relation in terms of periods of our closed one form. And this subspace resembles enormously the modular surface which we considered yesterday, the space of flat toroid of area 1. This guy is still non-compact, but not so desperately non-compact as before. It has sort of cusps, which were discussed yesterday in the lecture of Howie Mazur. Fine. So, and now we can confine so we can consider the measure on this subspace the measure which was defined just a second ago can be restricted, well, it can be induced to this hypersurface. And now the theorem. Which is, well, probably it's worth of, you know, in red it wouldn't be so visible, but it's really the key theorem in the story. Theorem contains three parts. The first says that the volume of every family like this is finite with respect to this measure. The second part says that SL2R action on these subspaces preserves the measure. And the third, probably the most important part, says that SL2R action and diagonal action are ergodic with respect to this measure. And so this is really the magic stick, the magic wand in this story, because I really want to repeat the general idea which was exploited many times and was extremely efficient in the study of flat surfaces and interval change transformations. And, well, to the best of my knowledge, it was first applied in the full strength, well, really in the full strength, or probably first applied in the proof of Mazur and Veitch of unique ergodicity of almost all interval change transformations. So, thank you. To get information about individual flat surface, or integral change transformation. Consider its orbit, it's SL2R, or orbit on the diagonal group depending on the context. Orbit and so certainly this idea should seem too abstract, but here is, say, one of the numerous illustrations. So here's an example, which is a theorem by Maser. So the vertical flow So if the vertical flow is not uniquely ergodic, then the orbit the diagonal action orbit escapes to infinity. Actually, I didn't, well, first, what does it mean escapes to infinity? We have a space which really resembles, in a sense, this modular surface which is non-compact as a cusp. So we can try, we can choose some compact subset on this thing. And one says that the orbit escapes to infinity if no matter what, how large is the compact subset was chosen, the orbit will eventually leave this compact subset and never comes back. So maybe you'll have, well, you take larger and larger compact subsets, you have to wait for a longer time and the orbit may come back and then so wander for a while, but escapes to infinity means that eventually it will leave and never come back. And actually, the statement of this theorem is even stronger than formulated, because one can take projection of this orbit downstairs to the modulized space of complex structures, and the orbit escapes to infinity even in the sense of, well, even downstairs. So an exercise try to apply this theorem to the case of tori. For the case of tori, the moduli space was drawn on the blackboard. It's more or less clear what directions are uniquely ergodic and what directions are not uniquely ergodic, so it's a nice exercise to apply this theorem in this baby case. So, okay. So this is more or less everything about generalities concerning flat surfaces. And now I want to, in the remaining time, I want to say several words about behavior of generic geodesics on flat surfaces. So closed geodesics were discussed yesterday in the lecture of Howie Maser, and there are already a lot of funnies concerning closed geodesics. Say, the results which were presented can be, so there are several numerous interpretations of the results which were presented yesterday. In particular, say, when you have a closed geodesic on a surface, on a flat surface like this, similar to the torus case, it appears not as a single closed geodesic, it appears in families. If you step a little bit from the closed geodesic and send another geodesic in the same direction, you again obtain a closed geodesic, so they obtain in families of parallel closed geodesics filling cylinders. Well, in the torus case, they fill all the torus. In the case of a flat surface, they wouldn't fill the whole flat surface because when you step too much to the right, at some point you hit the conical point. When you step too much to the left, at some point you hit the conical point. So you get a cylinder filled with closed geodesics. But the funny thing is that now you can leave the cylinder, you can go far away from the cylinder, and you can send a send a geodesic in the same direction as before. And in a sense, with non-zero probability, it will close up, and the length of this geodesic will be exactly the same as before. And there is, for a generic surface, generic in terms of this measure, there is no hope to find two geodesics which are going in the same direction having different length. They really want to have the same length because they are homologous. Or the same story when you have two saddle connections and you join them by a rope, and this rope, if you are lucky, is just a single segment, then, well, it has some direction, say northwest direction, and since we have two conical singularities, we have several northwest directions and one in the other. We can try to consider, to send a rope from one of these guys in northwest direction, and with non-zero probability, it will come back to the same point as before. So this was the story explained yesterday, this phenomenon of multiplicities for geodesics, in particular for closed geodesics, and today I want to say several words about generic geodesics. Like for torus, when you send a geodesic in a rational direction, it will close up, so it's a rare situation. If you send a geodesic in a direction chosen by random, you get a winding line on the torus which fills the entire torus. There is a theorem analogous to this one for flat surfaces, and this is a theorem. Generic geodesics on flat surfaces. And here's the theorem. This is a theorem of three authors, of Kirchhoff, Mazur, and Smiley. Which says that for any, and this I want to stress because this is a very nice, this is a rare theorem. One can say, something about any flat surface, for any flat surface, almost all directions are uniquely ergodic. The case when a direction is not uniquely ergodic is possible. For torus, it's not possible. Here, it's possible. It may happen that, in some direction, all geodesics are minimal, but somehow some geodesics prefer to stay on one part of the surface and the other on the other part of the surface. But generically, the story is the same as in the torus case, and I suggest to study how this geodesic winds around the surface. So, to do this, we can, for example, so here's, this is a topological picture, it's not a metric picture, so now this would be their, say, vertical direction. We can choose a transversal, and when the geodesic winds around the surface and hits our transversal, we can close up here the endpoint. So this is the starting point which will never change. This is the point of the first return to the transversal. And to get a closed loop, we can join the ends and we obtain a closed cycle. So here is our transversal. I will make a cartoon movie. That's the first cycle which we obtain. Then there would be some point when our vertical trajectory. I suppose that it's uniquely ergodic, very nice, and so on. So it really comes back to our transversal. So here would be the second cycle. When we hit the interval for the second time, I close up the ends, I join the ends to obtain a closed curve. So then there would be third one. And finally, it will wind around the surface for quite a while, and I obtain cycle CN. And I'm interested in this, so all these guys live in the first homology of the surface. Well, actually with integer coefficients, but I prefer to consider this as a lattice in the homology with real coefficients. I'm interested in the behavior of these cycles. So these guys, these cycles can be considered just as vectors in this vector space, which is 2G dimensional vector space. I am interested in the way these cycles are located in this vector space. From the theorem of Kirchhoff, Mazur, and Smiley, it follows immediately that actually there exists the following limit. Almost all directions, trajectories wind around the surface along the asymptotic cycle can be defined as a limit. So it's sufficient to normalize the cycle Cn by n, and this limit exists, and it does not depend on the choice of the starting point, it depends only on the choice of the direction. Well, up to normalization, because if I will choose the shorter subinterval here, which was this auxiliary subinterval used to close up the cycles, we have to spend more time to come back to it, and the asymptotic cycle will be longer. So we have to make some normalization, but choosing different transverse subintervals, I obtain proportional asymptotic cycles here. Okay. Now, the story I'm interested in is, how do these vectors deviate from the line, from the direction of this asymptotic sign? That would be the last story of today. It's really a pity to erase the key theorem. I like it very much. As soon as the direction is uniquely ergodic, C is non-zero, and so, which is part of the theorem. And actually, well, no, it can be obtained as a corollary of the old paper of Schwarzman, where the asymptotic cycles were defined. Because actually you can define asymptotic cycles not only in the ergodic situation, but then they depend on the starting point and so on. And here, thanks to ergodicity, they are, well, the asymptotic cycle shouldn't depend on the point. So, well, anyway. Okay. So, we have, now we have to have some room. We have a huge two-G dimensional vector space, so we have a lot of room, and we have this let this be the direction of this asymptotic cycle C, and we have a sequence of vectors . So these vectors become longer and longer, as it is clear, well, as it's clear from the remark that the asymptotic cycle is non-zero. And we know that their direction approaches the direction of this asymptotic cycle C. So this means that this angle tends to zero. But this doesn't mean that the distance from the endpoint of the vector to this line tends to zero. It just means that the length grows sublinearly. So the existence of the limit means just that probably I will keep this space. Sorry? I see. Arbitrary. I agree that, of course, there is no natural, there is no Euclidean structure, no inner product, there is no symplectic structure is, I cannot use symplectic structure. I just impose some arbitrary Euclidean structure in this space. And, sorry? No, just arbitrary. Everything will be so rough that nothing would depend on this. But the distance, in the sense of some arbitrarily chosen Euclidean metric, not necessarily sublinear growth. Now, to see. So it means that, in particular, that this distance can be relatively large, and I'm interested in the way these vectors deviate from this asymptotic direction. And to see this deviation, I suggest the following thing. Again, I repeat, I have chosen some Euclidean metric, so I can choose a screen which is orthogonal to this asymptotic direction, and I can project everything to this screen. I can project these vectors to the screen. Since the screen is orthogonal to this asymptotic direction, the asymptotic direction projects to zero. So I eliminate the part of the vectors which correspond to this asymptotic direction, and I see only the deviation. And the screen has codimension 1. So it's still 2G minus 1 dimensional, which is quite a lot. And now we can, so suppose we are doing computer experiment, we are projecting these vectors, and surprisingly what we see in the screen is a picture like this. So I have here only 4 vectors, I suppose that I have several millions. So there would be a cloud of points like this, but all these points will be aligned along some line. So, which means that actually there exists some plane. So probably, that our vectors, in a sense, leave so morally CG leave in a two-dimensional plane L2. Well, so this plane L2 is an analog of this asymptotic direction, and we can repeat our game. Now we can construct a screen which will be orthogonal to our plane L2. It will be a screen of codimension 2. We'll project everything to this next screen, and we'll observe more or less the same story as here. I'm projecting the vector space on the linear subspace along this direction. I'm making actually the good picture would be like this. We have sort of paraboloid and our vectors live inside this paraboloid. So if I will draw just a parabola, a usual flat parabola, and I will take vectors like this inside parabola, the angle between these vectors, which are getting longer and longer, will tend to zero. However, the distance from parabola to its axis tends to infinity. And that's exactly the story which happens here, except that this paraboloid is multidimensional, and so and the rate of escape from different subspaces is different. So the vectors live morally in a two-dimensional plane. Basically, they align along this asymptotic direction. But most of the deviation occurs inside of a plane. So when I make a projection here, this thing is really a one-dimensional line. It's not multidimensional thing. This projection to the screen of codimension 1, where we have a lot of room. However, all these guys try to align along really one-dimensional thing, which means that we have one dimension from asymptotic direction, which we killed under projection, and we have this extra dimension coming from here. So this defines this plane. It is spanned by this asymptotic direction and by this one-dimensional line. So now here's a little bit more, morally means that this is a second order of approximation, that you can take, you can take something which is orthogonal to this two-dimensional plane, and which is codimensional 2 subspace, and project everything there, and you'll again see more or less the same picture, but the rate of escape will be smaller than before, and that's what I want to write on the blackboard. So
Okay. So first.
So the first statement claims that there exists this asymptotic cycle. And it depends if I normalize like this, where x, so I normalize the area of the surface by 1, and I multiply by the length of the transverse interval, which was chosen here, to join the ends. So this is transverse interval x, which was used to join the endpoints of pieces of geodesic. So then the asymptotic cycle depends only on the flat surface S. I remind that here we keep the information about vertical direction, and I am working with the vertical direction. So this is the first statement. The second statement is that for any J between 1 and G minus 1, where G is the genus of the surface, Lim sup of the distance between the cycle and the subspace number G, well, and here I had to take logarithm, divided by logarithm of n, is equal to some number G plus 1, which means that, well, there is more, which means that the distance between this cycle and the subspace V, sorry, L, G is of the order norm of our cycle, length of our cycle, power of this number G plus 1, which is smaller than 1. And these numbers are getting smaller and smaller when we are taking larger subspaces. Now, the third property is that the distance between our cycle number n and the subspace number g is already uniformly bounded by a constant which depends only on the surface S, and actually here on the choice of Euclidean structure which we used to measure the distance. And the fourth item is that the numbers strictly greater than one are the top G Lyapunov exponents of technical geodetic flow. And now I have a very important remark. So initially, this theorem, which was formulated about 10 years ago, was a purely conditional theorem, because it was formulated modular assumption that the inequalities here are strict. So, and the problem about the spectrum of Lyapunov exponents and about simplicity of this spectrum is something, well, as usual, is something extremely painful. So for many years, this conjecture that the spectrum of Lyapunov exponents is simple was open. Then there was advance of Giovanni Forni, who proved that, who proved that these Lyapunov exponents are non-trivial. And this immediately gave, since there was a conditional theorem, this immediately gave this Lagrangian subspace here, but didn't prove that our subspaces in this flag jump in dimension by 1. So without having these inequalities, it's impossible to have any control on the jumps of the dimensions of these subspaces. Now, the theorem about simplicity of the spectrum of all Lyapunov exponents was recently proved by Arturo Avila and Marcelo Viana, and this was their, well, this made this theorem a theorem, because, well, only now, having the simplicity of the spectrum, it's possible to say that all the subspaces really grow in dimension one by one. So this is first remark. The second remark is that this is just an illustration of, well, the series of phenomena of this type in a particular case. So as an exercise, I suggest the following exercise. Consider a function on an interval and consider a generic interval change transformation in terms of a measure. Or consider a function on the surface and consider its ergodic averages with respect to the vertical flow. So the exercise is to formulate analogous result for these objects. And the second part of the exercise is to look in the papers of Giovanni Forni and to find the corresponding theorems where these results are formulated and proved. But to formulate them, that's already a nice exercise. So this phenomenon is really valid for somehow larger class of objects than just asymptotic cycles. In particular, it was proved in the papers of Giovanni Forni and Livio Flaminio that something similar happens for horocyclic flows, and well, there are some class of dynamical systems where there is, well, this phenomenon of deviation spectrum for ergodic averages of functions, and well, this is something typical for so-called, well, parabolic dynamics. So this is the second remark, and as usual, I'm out of time, so I have no time to give the proof of this story. Well, as a very slight excuse, I can say that, well, the idea of the proof is presented in the two or three pages of the notes which I just gave to the secretary, which will be distributed. Yeah, so that's it for today.
Statement for any flat surface and then almost every direction in that flat surface?
No, I do not.
That's false?
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Well, so there is an example of... Yeah, so there is a paper of Giovanni Forni which appears in their volume of Handbook and Dynamical Systems, volume 1b, which gives an explicit example of an arithmetic V surface having all Lyapunov exponents except the first one, zero. So at least this part of the story. So this part of the story is not always true. However, making a sacrifice and making a correction of this story, say if there are some multiplicities in the spectrum of Lyapunov exponents, whether something like this is true, well, with the correction for multiplicities. I don't know. Actually, this is, to my mind, this is something extremely challenging thing, the structure of this flag. So this flag should have some, especially this subspace. What is the distribution of these subspaces in homology? And, well, having my origins in topology, I'm badly curious whether this object has some topological meaning or it is something purely dynamical. So when you have this in multiplicative ergodic theorem and also Osserati's theorem, the distribution of the subspaces, well, usually it's terrible, just integrable, there is Bessian theory. Well, in some cases it's nice, but a priori it might be as bad as you don't wish. And here, well, I still hope that it might be some nice distribution which can be expressed in topological terms. And that would be really fine, because then it would be possible to apply machinery of algebraic topology and algebraic geometry to this stuff.
Distribution goes like this.
spaces, you mean the optimal spaces?
Yeah. So actually, these subspaces are used using multiplicative ergodic theorem for, well, if you wish, for Tychonic geodesic flow. But to my mind, a very challenging question is whether there is some purely topological definition of this thing without using this extremely implicit construction with multiplicative ergodic theorem. Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course the Lyapunov exponents depend on the invariant subspace, and this as soon as you have special orbit of SL2R action, you have different Lyapunov exponents. Yeah. So, yes. So, I strongly recommend a very recent paper, which is sort of a partial answer to your question. This is a paper of Martin Muller and of his collaborator, whose name I don't remember. It appeared in archive about a month ago, and it treats exactly the Veitch surfaces, and it constructs a whole bunch of new Veitch surfaces. And in particular, it treats Lyapunov exponents of this for Tychonic disks of Veitch surfaces, because there is a previous paper of Martin Muller where he proved that for Veitch surfaces, the corresponding vector bundle has invariant vector subbundles. And as usual, as soon as you have invariant vector subbundles, you can pick up parts you can regroup the Lyapunov exponents and get extra information about some of them. And then he applies the Kontsevich formula for the sum of Lyapunov exponents to obtain information about some individual ones. So.
Thank you.